Nell, Sonya said, head of the Magellan Billet. The two Americans then walked from the parking lot onto the grounds and approached the building that housed the Daniwovich shaft. They were met by a petite blonde woman, dressed in tan coveralls. Then all three headed away from the tourist area. I've learned that the American Polish ambassador was in contact with our communications office, the manager said. He arranged for Patricia, the woman you just saw, to meet the two visitors. She's one of our guides. She took them to the miners' entrance, where they dressed and descended about 5 minutes ago. I delayed them as long as I could without drawing suspicion. Where are they in the mine? Level 9. There are no cameras there, but all guides carry trackers that we can monitor. Mr. President, can I inquire as to the nature of this? You can, but it's a matter of state security. The two people on Level 9 are American intelligence agents. It's imperative they do not wander out of your electronic sight, and we need to go down there. Sonya motioned for them to step aside together. They left the room and stood alone out in a hallway. Are you sure about this? She asked. He looked at her puzzled. We, she said. Why don't you let me handle it? It's my life that's at stake. You're the president of this country. Act like it. Her tone was sharp. So he made no attempt to hide his frustration either. You told me this was over. You told me it was handled. It wasn't. We have no idea what's going on here. Yes, it bears investigating. Then a decision can be made once we know the facts. Right now, we're speculating. Even worse, we're guessing. What you're doing smacks of desperation. I am desperate. I've worked my whole life to get to this point. I won't allow that opportunity to be taken from me. Not without a fight. These were the first cross words that had ever passed between them, and he hated they were being said. But he meant every one. He'd worked too long and too hard to be cut short now. If salvation waited below, then salvation he would find. Her eyes softened. You're in my charge. There's a clear danger here. From Malone? I didn't think he was a problem. We have no idea who's here. The Russians could be around. I can't be cavalier about your safety. We should inform the BOR. There's little they can do. She reached out and touched his arm. All the more reason to proceed with caution. He stared at her and saw she could read his thoughts. All right, she said, resignation in her voice. We'll go together. She turned for the door. He grabbed her arm. I'm sorry for blaming you. I know you only did what you thought necessary. Killing Olivier could not have been easy. I did what had to be done. She paused. And if I'd thought for a moment we'd end up here right now with this dilemma, I would have handled it differently. I genuinely thought this was over. I know. Again. I'm sorry. They stepped back into the control room. We're ready, he told the manager. We'll need a way to track the guide, Patricia, from down there. We have handheld monitors. Sonya's gaze was locked on the screens. Hard to tell which one had grabbed her attention. What is it? He asked. Look there, on the fourth one down from the top, right side. He did, and saw four men dressed in coveralls, walking toward an elevator. All wore hard hats with lights. That's Eli Reinhardt and his man Munoz. He knew the names. The big one is Ivan. He knew that name, too. Fox's declaration about the Russians had not been idle chatter. He pointed at the screen and asked, Where is that? The Regis shaft, not far from here. They can get to level 9 from there, Sonya asked. The manager nodded. Of course, but it's a walk. He pointed at the screen. Who's with them? The manager studied the screen. It's one of our guides, David Conrad. We'll need to track him, too, Sonya said. But he doubted that was going to be a problem, since they were all headed to the same place. Chapter 63. Eli rode in the elevator, which purred in a steady, controlled fall to 300 meters below ground. With Ivan around, he was glad to have Munoz with him. They were both armed with the weapons from the castle. Good thing, too, as surely there were Russian reinforcements waiting above. It was doubtful he'd make it away from the mine in one piece if Ivan was challenged. But he was no fool, either. Once the information on Tchaikovsky was located, no reason existed to keep him alive. On the contrary, every reason existed for him to die. Ivan had shot two of his own men with no hesitation. He'd already told Munoz to stay alert, and at the first opportunity they'd make their escape, getting lost in the mine and finding another way out. Ivan could have the information for free. He just wanted this to end. What had at first seemed a profitable idea had turned into a disaster. At least he still had 5 million euros and the pantry, which the Russians apparently knew nothing about, as there'd been no mention of its existence. The elevator came to a stop, and the metal doors opened to a lit foyer and an unlit tunnel beyond. They stepped out into chilly air. The solitude of the uninviting blackness swallowed him as they entered the tunnel, their headlamps illuminating about 10 meters ahead.
"Where you want to go is a long walk from here," Conrad said.
"Then let us start," Ivan said. "I don't move so fast." Eli had always imposed a rigorous discipline on himself. He'd dealt with Israelis, Americans, French, Congolese, Chinese, South Africans, you name the buyers, anyone and everyone had been a customer. Unlike Olivier, who had an abhorrence for killing, he'd never harbored any such reservations. But killing this Russian would come with dire consequences. And Ivan knew that. Eli tried to dismiss the disturbing thoughts swirling through his brain, but couldn't. Like fat on a man who'd always been lean, they slowed him down. But he forced himself to focus and kept following their beams down the wide tunnel.
"Amazing place," Ivan said. "It shows what 40 generations of hard work can do," Conrad noted. "They just kept digging, making money for the king."
Eli was not ignorant of the salt mine. Though there were larger and older caverns in both Poland and Europe, they paled in comparison with this vast labyrinth, hundreds of kilometers long, so like the Minotaur's lair. Everything about it screamed monumental. Mines had always fascinated him, particularly how the Nazis used them in Germany and Austria in the last war as secret vaults. Here the treasure had been far more practical. Salt. What a thing. A rock. Hard but fragile. But also a symbol, a measure of wealth, a spice, and a raw material. Once entire kingdoms depended on its trade. Not so much anymore. If he'd lived centuries ago and worked the mine, he would have wanted to be a treasurer. They ruled the underground. Miners simply called them he. No name, just he. It was the treasurer who rewarded hard work and punished the lazy. The treasurer who delivered a harsh slap across the face to any miner who cursed. The treasurer who warned against danger, scampering through the tunnels, examining the ceiling and walls, blocking the path to places where trouble lurked. They kept walking down the drift. Conrad led the way, Ivan next, then himself, with Munoz in the rear. He wanted to keep the Russian ahead of him where he could see his every move, for whatever good that would offer. He could hear the fat man's heavy breathing, obviously unaccustomed to a brisk workout. Maybe Ivan would have a coronary. He could only hope. Eli had not made a name for himself by being either bashful or cowardly, and he wasn't going to embrace either weakness now. Be smart and patient, he told himself. The tunnel forked. The right side was blocked by a sign. Vstep vzbronione. No entry. Dripping disturbed the silence from down the blocked path. Past a rope barrier, in the combined beams of their lights, he saw water seeping from the ceiling. A respectable puddle had formed on the floor beneath. Not a recent leak, either. Crystallized salt, white as snow, painted the walls.
"Is that okay?" he asked Conrad. "It happens all the time. We come down and make repairs."
"What would happen if you didn't?"
"The water would slowly eat it all away, one salt crystal at a time. But don't worry, that would take about 150 years. We're okay."
"How far to go?" he asked Conrad.
"Another few minutes."
He turned to leave, and his helmet slipped from his head, clattering down the salt wall and finding the floor, the light beam dancing in the darkness.
"My apologies," he said, retrieving the headgear.
Ivan stood facing him. Beneath those coveralls was a gun, too. Probably the same one used to shoot two of his own men back at Stornik Castle. Normally, Eli stayed in control, at the head of the parade. Here, he was nothing more than a spectator. He tried not to think of the darkness around him and what it might contain. But one thing he knew for sure. Nothing could be as threatening as a Russian. Chapter 64 Cotton followed Stephanie and their guide down the tunnel on level 9. The trip into the bowels of the mine had required two elevators, one to level 3, then a second from there to level 9. Patricia had used her fob to activate both elevators, confirming her previous observation that not just anyone could descend this deep. She'd also noted that a count was kept of everyone who entered the mine, including every tourist. At the end of each day, the ins and outs were reconciled so that nobody could remain. Cleaning crews worked during the day on the upper levels, so at night the mine was essentially shut down, the last tour switching off the lights, everything left in blackness until the following morning. The time was approaching 6 p.m., another hour and a half before the site officially closed. They needed to work fast, staying ahead of not only the tourists, but also the Russians, the Poles, and any new Americans who might show up. A chilly, salt-laced breeze blew in his face, helping dissipate any feelings of claustrophobia. It wasn't enclosed spaces that drove him nuts. It was enclosed, tight spaces he hated. He had to keep telling himself to ignore the fact that over 900 feet of rock lay between him and daylight. Patricia told them that following the direction of the air served as a means of navigation, one the miners still used. The rough floor was full of obstacles and slippery in places. The silence pressed onto him as if the tunnel were collapsing. He imagined the sounds from a former time, when horses moved the heavy salt blocks, their hooves clunking on the hard floor. Rail cars eventually replaced them, which came with the screech of metal on metal. "You know your way around these tunnels?" Stephanie asked as they walked.
"I bring groups down here all the time. They grind salt like the miners once did."
The whole place had an air that did not speak of things neglected. Offshoots appeared with regularity, leading into more absolute blackness. "I assume it would be easy to get lost," he noted.
"More misdirected," Patricia said. "At some point you'll come to stairs or an elevator leading up. It's big, but it's a finite world."
He smiled at her sarcasm.
"Keep an eye out for the White Lady, though," she said.
Had he heard right? A Dame Blanche? Obviously not a chocolate sundae. So he asked what she meant.
"The miners called her Bialichka, supposedly a spirit that roams the tunnels looking for a miner she'd once loved."
"Good to know." The tunnel spanned about 6 feet wide and 8 tall, and the steady breeze kept bringing a measure of comfort. The darkness seemed omnipotent and impenetrable, but not frightening. No sunrises or sunsets happened here, no midnights or middays. For those long ago miners who worked here for weeks at a time, only the light from their lanterns had brought a reprieve. He thought of those miners and how they probably heard down here for the first time the sound of their own breath, their own heartbeat. How odd that must have been. But the silence was also threatening, since it lulled the brain into a false sense of security. He had to constantly tell himself to stay alert. Trouble could be around the next turn. Or behind them. Hard to know anything for sure. If Cassiopeia could see him now, she would not be happy. But at least he'd be done and back in Copenhagen by tomorrow evening. They'd have a great weekend. Dinner at Newhaven, then Tivoli on Saturday or Sunday. They both loved the amusement park. She'd stay until Tuesday or Wednesday, then head back to southern France. Her castle reconstruction project kept going forward. No surprise. She was a determined woman who could do anything she set her mind to. He focused on thoughts of her as a way to avoid the obvious discomfort around him. How she painted her bread with butter in short, even strokes, covering every square inch until the knife was shiny clean. Salt was always poured into her open palm before being dispensed. Never did she eat ice cream in a cone. Too much pressure to perform before it melted. She hated apple juice, but loved apples, green ones especially, and potato chips. She loved them with only spicy mustard. Everyone had their quirks. God knew he had a long list of them. He'd have to come clean about all that had happened this week, and she wouldn't be happy to have been left out. But she'd understand, like always. That was their way. They both tended to find trouble, and they both always tried to handle it by themselves. Admitting they needed help seemed a weakness, but he trusted no one more than Cassiopeia. She'd never let him down, nor would he disappoint her. The tunnel drained into a chamber. Several shadows, large and fast, detached themselves from the darkness and assumed form in their lights. Two weathered statues, whose florid features had fallen into a portrait of despair. They framed the entrance to a nave cut into the far wall through the salt.
St. Peter of Alcantara on the left, St. Casimir on the right, Patricia said. Not in good shape, as you can see. Leached by humidity and water leaks. Everything on this level has succumbed to some degree.
With his headlamp, he studied the rest of the chamber.
The chapels were strategically placed, Patricia said, near wells and shafts where new salt deposits were found, so prayers could be conducted.
They were also landmarks. Lamps burning inside them were source points for workers, a place where they could safely congregate and reignite their own when it extinguished. Stephanie stayed quiet, and he saw the concern on her face.
Here they were, underground, one gun between them. Were they alone?
So far, so good. He found her gaze and said with his eyes, "Why don't you stay here? Let me finish this." She shook her head. "My problem. My fix."
"St. Bobola is that way," Patricia said, pointing to an exit off to the right.
He gestured for Stephanie to go first. Something echoed in the distance, a clattering sound, far off, like a stone down a deep well, and the hair on the back of his neck bristled. Chapter 65. Tchaikovsky wore coveralls, as did Sonia. They helped with anonymity, all provided by the mine manager. They were back in the security office with the video screens.
"I'm told," the mine manager said, "that Malone and Ms. Nell, along with the Russian you identified and two others, are now all on level 9.
"Are they aware of each other?" Sonia asked. The man shook his head.
"Unlikely. The trackers and the guides show them far apart, but heading in the same direction."
"We need to get down there," he said. Sonia shook her head.
"I've been thinking on that."
He was curious. "What do you suggest?"
"At some point, they have to get out," Sonia said. "So let's keep them underground and force them to the upper levels, where there are lights, cameras, and people. We can take them down there."
He saw the wisdom in the move. She faced the mine manager.
"Can you shut down the elevators that go all the way to the bottom and leave only the one up from level 9 to level 3 working?"
The man nodded.
"Then all we have to do is wait at level 3, she said. "They'll come to us."
He really wanted to head for level 9. No telling what was going to happen. But there was nothing to be gained by rushing into the unknown, especially when nobody knew they were even here. They had the advantage. So, wait. He nodded.
The tours are winding down for the day, the manager said. Fewer people will be on the upper levels as they head for the surface. Most of the people there will be in line, waiting for an open elevator up. Those lines are long this time of day.
Can you stop the tours for the day? He asked. Close early.
It's most unusual.
This whole thing is unusual.
And he saw the manager understood.
I'll do it.
Then, Sonia asked, can you get us to level 3 unnoticed?
They descended a wooden staircase, strong and sturdy, built to last from solid timbers. Tourists could choose walking down to levels 1 and 2 or take the elevators. Most rode. He and Sonia walked. He noticed that few were making the climb up, and no one was heading down. Surprisingly, after nearly 400 steps, he wasn't all that winded. He just hoped he didn't have to use them to get back up. The manager had stayed above to keep an eye on what was happening on level 9, saying he would meet them below shortly. They came to the bottom and stepped off onto a salt floor. No cold, dark, damp passages awaited. Instead, everything was well lit, with an arid but comfortable temperature and a steady breeze of fresh air. He assumed the mine had to be kept as dry as possible to prevent humidity from dissolving the salt. The manager had told them to head for the Copernicus chamber, which was not far away. They followed the signs and passed within sight of the elevators up, spotting lines of people waiting to leave.
Let's keep going, Sonia said to him.
They followed a corridor into a spacious chamber that housed a larger-than-life-sized statue of the famous astronomer. Timber frames supported masonry blocks along 3 walls. Logs stood at attention, one after the other forming a 4th wall behind the statue. A simple, almost modernistic representation, the arms outstretched, the open palms holding a celestial sphere. A handful of people loitered about, snapping a few final pictures before leaving.
He studied in Krakow and lived in Fromborg, he said, pointing at the salt carving. What courage it took to say that the Earth was not the center of the universe. That simple idea fundamentally changed humanity forever. You're an admirer? Absolutely. He was an astronomer, with a doctorate in canon law. He was self-taught as a physician, polyglot, translator, diplomat, and economist. He spoke 5 languages. He's the father of the scientific revolution, and most important, he was a Pole.
A placard near the statue stated that in 1493, while a student in Krakow, Copernicus visited the mine. Perhaps the first tourist ever to do so, the text suggested. The statue was carved in 1973 to commemorate the genius's 500th birthday.
I don't like being helpless, he whispered. You're not. We have the situation under control. Let Malone and the Russians fight it out below. Whoever emerges, we will deal with. They have no idea we're here, and there's only one way out.
The others left the chamber. The manager appeared at the far side and walked their way.
We have everything contained. All of the tour groups that were in the lower levels are now topside. Level 9 is empty except for the 2 groups we're watching. We have all the exits guarded, with the only way out through here. I assume there's a place where we can watch that elevator.
The man nodded.
There is a spot, not far away, down on level 3. The passageways here move between the 3 levels. We'll continue to ferry people up, and as you asked, we've stopped selling tickets for the day. I've had all of the guides instructed to keep their groups near the elevators, or in the cafe and the adjacent dining hall.
He'd never been one to solve problems from the bottom. Smart people started from the top, and he'd always considered himself smart. Never had he done anything legally wrong or corrupt in his life. The Warsaw Protocol? That was war. Different rules,
But if he was forced to defend himself and reveal the truth to counter the documents, how many would agree with him? Not enough. Most would see him as a spy for the communists, providing information on his friends, family, and acquaintances, that he sold out his country. Few would believe the Warsaw Protocol ever existed. Those who did might think him a murderer, a classic lose-lose. And the resulting firestorm would not be survivable. Candidates had been destroyed with far less damaging slander. Things like being called insensitive to war veterans, labeled narcissistic, elitist, bragging about their education, poor health, even staring too long at a video monitor during an interview. All had been used in attempts to destroy campaigns. But an even greater danger existed, one that history cautioned should not be ignored: the possibility of dividing Poland. Something similar had happened before. Not here, but in France. He knew the incident well. In 1894, a traitor was discovered within the French army, a spy, passing information to the Germans. An investigation revealed the potential culprit. Captain Alfred Dreyfus, a French artillery officer of Jewish descent, who was found guilty and sent to solitary confinement on Devil's Island. 2 years later, an investigation unearthed the real culprit, who was tried. But officials suppressed vital evidence, and the man was acquitted. The army then accused Dreyfus of more charges with more falsified evidence. Dreyfus was retried and found guilty again, but was pardoned and set free. Eventually, it was proven that all of the accusations against Dreyfus were baseless. But the whole thing bitterly divided France. One half defended everything, pro-army, mostly Catholic, screaming absolute loyalty to the nation. Dreyfus was a Jew who could not be trusted. He had to be a spy. The other half, anti-clerical, pro-republican, wanted justice for all, regardless of religion. Political parties chose sides. Families split, sometimes for more than a generation. The debate continued for decades and remained even today, with the France for the French nationalism clashing with a more global vision of the rule of law and a nation for everyone. Incredible. One court case created unresolvable divisions between people who never knew they disagreed with each other. It also revealed two vastly different views of what people thought was France. The same would happen in Poland. Revealing the Warsaw Protocol would open wounds that had never healed. What happened from 1945 to 1990 remained as fresh as yesterday in the minds of many Poles. Divisions already existed. Attacks on foreigners were steadily increasing. Just recently, a 14-year-old Turkish girl was beaten on the street while her attackers shouted, "Poland for Poland." Anti-Semitic demonstrations had become commonplace, with Jews burned in effigy. Jokes about the Holocaust were no longer unacceptable. Pro-fascist rallies happened monthly. Crimes committed from racial prejudice were on the rise. There'd even been a massive neo-Nazi march during last year's celebration of Polish independence. It would be easy for the populace to add one more divide to that mix. Some would agree with the protocol's radical tactics. Traitors had it coming. Solidarity did what it had to do. Others would find the lies and deaths no different from what the communists did. Solidarity, nothing but hypocrisy. The debate would be endless. There'd be political shifts. Ones, as in France, that would split families and friends, cut across social classes, and rearrange long-standing alliances. Old wounds would bleed again. Sonia was staring, allowing him his thoughts. He wanted to talk to her, to explain, seek her help, but knew better. This was better kept to himself, at least for now. One of the curses of being president. But the fact remained that much more was at stake here than just his political career. Chapter 66. Cotton ran his hand along the walls.
Parts were smooth, like glass, others sharp and rough, easily capable of slicing skin. "Why is it gray?" he asked Patrizia.
"The salt is impure. It has some magnesium and calcium mixed with it, which is good for you. That's what once made this salt so highly valued."
They walked in the center of the tunnel, over grooves made long ago by heavy carts. All around were stalactites and stalagmites in the irregular shapes salt crystals adopted from water intrusion. One wall was totally sheathed in bright white cauliflower-like formations.
"Do a lot of people come down here?" Stephanie asked. "Oh, yes. It is a busy place. When the Austrians controlled the mine in the 18th century, they set up the first tourist routes. The price of a ticket then depended on the quality of the light provided. Torches were a basic fee, but fireworks were expensive."
"They actually set off pyrotechnics down here?" he asked.
"As crazy as that sounds, they did, and the price depended on the color used."
The sound from earlier continued to bother him, but Patrizia explained that it was probably just another tour group. Many ventured to level 9 during each day, but as she explained, they all stayed closer to the elevators. None ventured this deep into the tunnels. Their path drained into another chamber, larger than the ones they'd already encountered, and different in that pillars had been left across it from floor to ceiling. He counted 8, along with spotting 2 other exits.
"Is this some sort of junction?" Stephanie asked.
Patrizia nodded.
"The miners would use this as a starting point, then dig to the next deposits. That's why there is a chapel here."
Her light revealed a small room, separate and individual, that jutted from one wall into a square-shaped cavity. Heavy timbers framed out its entrance, a set of beams securing the opening on all 4 sides, supported by a thick center post. Across the top, scrawled in white chalk, was Kaplička Święta Franciszka. Patrizia pointed at the words.
"Chapel of St. Francis. Kaplička means small chapel."
Cotton stepped across to the framed opening. Past it, in his headlamp, he spied a crucifix relief chipped from the wall. Beneath, a thick salt shelf rested on 2 projecting wooden dowels. A few feet away, a wooden pew had been constructed of plank boards and faced the altar. Neighboring walls held small niches with crude statues, one he recognized from the book back at the castle. St. Bobola. Stephanie and Patrizia came up beside him and added more illumination.
"This is it," he said.
Eli stopped. Both Conrad and Ivan had halted too, along with Munoz behind him.
"I heard voices," he whispered. "It could be another tour group," Conrad noted.
"Perhaps. But caution was the word for this day.
Let's go slow and make sure it's not a problem."
He stared at Ivan.
"You said Malone was in the vicinity." "I never received a report on what happened," Ivan breathed out. "You think he's here?"
"I don't know what to think. But we need to be careful."
The Russian broke into a toothy grin.
"Good advice, comrade. I agree. We be careful."
"How much farther?" Eli asked Conrad.
"Around the next 2 bends, and we're there."
"Lead way," Ivan said to Conrad, who began heading off into the darkness.
Ivan unzipped his jumpsuit, removed a gun, and kept it down at his side, finger on the trigger, but shielded from view by the big man's thigh. The Russian headed off. Eli turned back to Munoz, who'd done the same thing with his weapon. His acolyte nodded.
"Ready."
Cotton stepped into the chapel. Simple and austere, everything stained white by humidity. Graffiti decorated the roof bars that had been inserted along the rear wall for strength. Random words and letters, initials, numbers, dates. A layer of crushed salt lay across the floor like sand.
"What's with all the writing on the wood?" he asked. "From the miners over the centuries. We don't eliminate what they left."
"What exactly are we looking for?" Stephanie asked him. 147 pages of documents. So it should be about that thick.
His index finger and thumb showed 3/4 of an inch or so of space. He stepped over to St. Bobola and saw that, like the crucifix, the distorted sculpture was not a separate piece. Instead, it and the niche itself had been chipped from the wall in bas-relief. No way anything was either behind or under. The same was true with the other images. Everything pointed to here. But where? Think. Eli heard the voices at the same time everyone else did, and they all stopped. Ivan motioned, and they extinguished their lights, Conrad the last to catch on to what was happening and follow suit. They stood in absolute darkness.
"Is our destination just ahead?" he whispered. "Around the next bend," Conrad breathed out.
"Somebody already there," Ivan said.
Both Ivan and Munoz were armed, the darkness now concealing that fact from Conrad. Eli knew what had to be done.
"Conrad, stay here," he said to the blackness. "We have to investigate." "We go ahead with one light pointed to floor," Ivan added.
"Agreed."
Cotton narrowed the choices and decided there could only be one solution. The wooden pew. It was the only thing not built of salt in the makeshift chapel. Crude and simple in construction, fashioned from rough-cut 1x6 and 1x8 planks nailed together, about 4 feet wide, with a bench for sitting and an angled platform for resting hands or a hymnal while kneeling. He stepped over and lifted the structure, setting it to one side. Beneath, the salt floor was solid and undisturbed. He brushed it with his shoe. Little to no give was returned, like concrete. He looked at Stephanie, who nodded. They were thinking the same thing. Nothing buried. He tipped the makeshift pew over. Nothing. Its base was composed of 1x8 boards fashioned into rectangles. One was set at the rear beneath the bench where a penitent could sit, while the other formed a kneeler. They were tacked together with headless nails. "There's a compartment formed in both of those," he said. The trick was opening them. He threw his weight and gave 2 swift kicks with his boot. The thin wood split and parted from the frame. He pushed through the splinters and saw he was right. There was a compartment, but it was empty. He turned his attention to the other base support and pounded it too. Inside, taped to the boards, was a vacuum-sealed plastic pouch. Now the machine he'd spotted back at the castle made sense. It contained a manila envelope, similar to the one in which he'd found the book back at the castle. He wrenched it free. "This is it." And a gun fired. Chapter 67 Tchaikovsky sat at a long wooden table inside a spacious hall adorned with salt chandeliers, the room available for rent for large cultural and business events. He'd once attended a concert here, the Wrocław Philharmonic, if he recalled right, with a wonderful cello concerto. A treat at 125 meters underground, the acoustics near perfect. Adjacent to the hall was the Miner's Tavern, hacked from more gray salt, which served an excellent array of Polish food. 2 years ago, he hosted a dinner here for participants in a European energy summit. He especially recalled the chocolate tart served that day. What a delight! Nobody was in the hall or the cafe at the moment, as business was clearly winding down early, thanks to the mine manager. Incredibly, there was cell phone service, courtesy of hard lines from the surface and repeaters stationed throughout the tourist levels, which made it possible for him to speak with his wife, who'd called.
"I just left Jasnogora," she said to him through the phone. "Brother Hatia and I had a lovely chat."
He could only imagine. Is he still refusing to cooperate? He kept his voice low and a hand up, covering his mouth.
"Once he knew that I knew the truth, his attitude changed. Of course, he berated you for telling me and simply denied everything. What he didn't know is that while we were chatting, I had the BOR search his room. he smiled. Nothing about her was subtle or sublime. Find anything?
A thick file.
He was shocked.
You have it?
I do. And by the way, you two are a lot alike. But I assume you already realized that fact.
Long ago, in fact. He was perhaps one of the few people in Poland who could call the owl a friend. But that had seemed to count for little. He decided to keep to himself what was happening in the mine. There was nothing she could do about any of it. But if things went wrong here, having a record of the Warsaw Protocol could prove helpful.
You did good, he told her. I appreciate it. Just doing my part.
And she ended the call. He stared around at the hall and its stage at the far end. What an amazing place. A huge cavity, carved entirely from salt. A hole in the earth, which reminded him of Bolesław the Brave and the legend of the Sleeping Kings. Every schoolchild knew the tale. Once a year, at midnight, on Christmas Eve, the mighty Sigismund bell rung, and the Polish kings woke from their eternal sleep and gathered in a grand underground hall. A place with plenty of light, like a cathedral. Some say it lay beneath Wawel Castle, but others said it was much farther south, in the Tatra Mountains. Or maybe it was here, in Wieliczka. Who knew? They came dressed in their coronation robes, sitting before a round table, discussing the fate of the country. Bolesław himself presided, holding the famous Sterbiec, Poland's coronation sword. What a sight that would have been. But they were not the only ones who arose that night. The sleeping knights of the Tatra also roamed on Christmas Eve. They would leave the mountains on their white horses and ride off in search of the kings. Once found, a loud knock would come to the hall's door. Then, again, and one more time. Always three. The kings would fall silent as Bolesław opened the door, telling the knights, "No, the time has not yet come." He smiled at the drama. And irony. Men there, ready to fight, ready to serve Poland. But the time had not yet come. Before the kings resumed their council, they would listen to the fading hoofbeats as the knights rode back to their icy caves. Once there, the knights fed their animals, then fell asleep, leaning against their saddles in readiness. For when the time comes. What a glorious tale. His phone buzzed. A text. From his private secretary. He'd left instructions with his BOR detail to return to the Sheraton in Krakow and pretend he was back inside the Royal Wawel suite. He'd called his private secretary and told him that he was going to rest for a few hours and did not want to be disturbed. Unless vital. He read the message. United States issued statement that Deputy National Security Advisor Thomas Bunch is missing somewhere in Poland. He was here on official business under diplomatic immunity, and Washington has called on Warsaw to act immediately and ascertain his whereabouts. The Foreign Ministry wants to know our response. Fox had tossed the first salvo, shining a light. But the statement's wording allowed room to maneuver. He typed his reply. Tell the Americans we are sympathetic to the situation and will investigate. Also, have the Foreign Ministry inquire as to the exact nature of the official business the deputy was engaged in. We require details to aid in our investigation. He smiled. That should slow Fox down. Enough. So that what was about to happen could play itself out.
Chapter 68. Cotton reacted to the sudden bang that reverberated off the salt, throbbing his eardrums, which hurt. The sound surprised him, so out of place given the constant silence. Patricius screamed, and his gaze shot to the outer chamber as a large form materialized from the darkness, seeking cover behind one of the pillars. They were sitting ducks in this confined space, their headlamps beacons upon which to aim. So he reached for the battery pack at his waist and switched off the power. Stephanie followed suit, but Patricia lagged. He lunged and brought her down to the floor, switching her light off too. Darkness now engulfed them. He heard movement in the outer chamber, feet scuffing across brittle salt. He reached out for the overturned pew to use for cover. Their assailants' headlamps were also off, but nothing would prevent them from strafing the chapel with gunfire. The pew could offer some cover, but not much.
"Nowhere to go, Malone," a voice said from the blackness.
Ivan. Hard to tell exactly where, thanks to the echo and the black ink, both of which disoriented the senses with a lack of reference points. "Get over here," he whispered to Stephanie and Patricia, "and stay low." He reached out into the blackness, guiding them behind the pew.
"We meet again, Mr. Malone," an older voice said.
"Reinhardt."
"You know what I want," Ivan said. "I saw what you found."
But he wasn't ready to concede just yet. The darkness worked both ways, though it was a long way from where they crouched to the exit tunnel in the outer room, and their assailants' lamps, if switched on, would illuminate them like a deer in headlights.
"I could kill all you," Ivan said, "then come get it myself. Be reasonable, Malone. I really not want to shoot you."
Like he believed that one. Ivan would do whatever he had to do in order to get what he wanted. All those dead bodies back in Slovakia were proof of that. He and Stephanie were pros. They knew the risks. But Patricia was another matter. He owed her safety.
"All right, Ivan. Here it is."
And he tossed the packet toward where he thought was the chapel entry. A light went on. He shielded his pupils and saw a black form beneath a headlamp retrieve the packet. In one hand, he spied a pistol. A quick flash of the face showed the form to be Munoz, Reinhardt's man. Shapes hard to discern moved in the darkness. The light extinguished.
"We leave now, Malone," Ivan said. "Stay where you are."
Obviously, there was another way to this point through Level 9, since they'd encountered no one on the trip here. He assumed Ivan and company would utilize that path back out. So he was surprised when four lights came on, then disappeared into the tunnel through which Patricia had led them. "Why that way?" he asked her.
"Much quicker to an elevator. They probably came down from the Regis shaft, which is about a kilometer away."
They continued to sit in the dark. "I'm going after them," he said. "Stephanie, you and Patricia head back the way we came." "Like hell," his old boss said.
"I agree," their guide added.
Stephanie, he could understand, but the young Pole was being foolish. "Patricia, this is about to get real messy.
And you don't have a clue where you're going without me. I saw the face of one of the men who just left. He's a miner who works as a guide. They have help. You need it too."
She had a point, and he admired her bravery. "All right, let's go. One light only, mine," which would make him the first target. "They should be far enough down the tunnel that we can head after them. You don't happen to know another way back to that elevator that doesn't involve the tunnel they took?"
"Actually, I do."
Eli followed Ivan. Thankfully, the Russian had volunteered to stay in front of him. The big man carried a gun in one hand and the sealed packet in the other. Munoz had handed it over back in the chamber. He debated whether to kill the fat Slav and take his chances with anybody waiting above. But the Russian Foreign Service, the SVR, was every bit as ruthless as its predecessor, the KGB. Its staff and resources were endless, and there would literally be no place to hide anywhere on the globe. Not to mention the Americans, French, Iranians, North Koreans, and Chinese who would want to exact revenge for their losses, too. The smart play, the only play, was to allow Ivan his moment and get out of this mine and away with his 5 million euros. The pantry was still one level below him, and he could barter it to the Poles. Personally, he would have killed Malone and the others back in the chamber. But Ivan had made it clear that was not to happen.
He did not want to antagonize the Americans any further by generating another martyr they could rally behind. Better to let Malone and Stephanie Nell be embarrassed over their failure to secure the information. They kept walking, following Conrad down the dark tunnel, their lights illuminating the way. The chilly breeze in their face felt good and brought the anticipated comfort of fresh air above. Around two bends, and they came to the elevator. Conrad stopped before the closed doors.
"When do I get paid?"
"That's not my problem," Ivan said. Conrad pointed at Eli.
"It's his problem. 100,000 euros, and no one said anything about guns and shooting. Weapons are not allowed here. We could all be in trouble if anyone heard that shot."
"But apparently no one did," Eli said.
"You said I would be paid once I led you to that statue. It's done. Where is my money?"
Ivan raised his gun and fired. Cotton heard a shot from somewhere in the echoing darkness.
"How far to the elevators?" he asked Patrizia.
"Just ahead."
Eli motioned, and Munoz dragged Conrad's body back down the tunnel and into one of the offshoots they'd just passed.
"Was that necessary?" he asked Ivan.
"We can't afford that witness."
But he needed Conrad to get back to the pantry. Now another way would have to be found. Damn Russians.
"Can you afford me as a witness?" he asked.
Ivan chuckled.
"I was told to leave you be. You have friends in Kremlin who like doing business with you. No worry."
Ivan motioned with the packet.
"We have what we want.
Some comfort, but not enough, since Russians lied." Munoz returned. He wondered how long it would be before the body was found. Hours? Unlikely. Days? Probable. Which was fine. He'd already thought it all through and saw Munoz had been thorough, handing over Conrad's fob that activated the elevator.
"We go up to level 3 and blend in with the tourists leaving for the day. That way,"
he motioned with the fob,
"this gets recorded as having been used to leave from down here. We remove these coveralls and walk right out with the rest of the visitors. Nobody's the wiser."
Ivan smiled, then reached out and clamped a paw on his right shoulder.
"Good plan."
Chapter 69. Tchaikovsky still sat at the table in the meeting hall. A few people had wandered in and out, but no one had paid him any attention, thinking him a mine employee thanks to the coveralls. Sonia was dealing with the mine manager, checking out the situation and determining how they would proceed. She'd thought it best he wait here, which had given him time to speak with Anna. Interesting how his fate might rest in the hands of two women. One, his estranged wife whom he'd once loved. The other, a woman whom he now loved. Both working in concert, their goal the same. To save his ass. Some men might see that as emasculating. Not him. His entire life he'd tried to do the right thing. But defining right had sometimes proven tricky. Dealing with the communists had required extreme measures, both offensive and defensive. Back then, they'd lumped it all under the label of resistance. An easy thing to describe. Difficult to understand, since its actions took many differing forms. Eventually, he'd come to learn the difference between revolution and resistance. Revolution looked ahead to what could be. Resistance dreamed of the past and a restoration of what once existed. Both, though, were paid for in exile, prison, torture, and death. He and millions of others had resisted the communists, wanting nothing more than a free Poland restored. It had been a war. Exactly how the communist government described it, declaring that there will be no turning back from socialism. And the government supported that declaration with 50,000 SB internal security forces deployed throughout the country, who broke strikes, coerced, and intimidated the people with death, violence, and fear. Spies played an integral part on both sides. It truly was war, and there were casualties on both sides. Sitting here now,
over 3 decades later, within the cocoon of an underground hall. It all seemed like yesterday. But lately his mind had stayed deep in the past. The government had been so stupid, so foolish, adhering to what Stalin had practiced. The people who cast votes decide nothing. The people who count votes decide everything. Which, luckily, evolved into a disaster for them. He could not repeat those mistakes, nor allow others to do so. In truth, he was replaceable. He could be gunned down at any time, in any crowd, and the police would have his blood hosed from the pavement and traffic flowing again by nightfall. Sad, but not a lie. In Poland, no one person controlled much of anything. Everything was a consensus. Nothing good would come from revealing the Warsaw Protocol. Any defense he might mount would be drowned out by a screaming opposition. There was no internet in the 1980s, no social media, no Twitter. Information could actually be contained. The backlash today would be relentless. A multitude of Polish political parties who could not agree on a single thing would unite under one common theme: removing him from office. And they would succeed. His entire ruling coalition revolved around the other side staying fractured, since, sadly, creating unity within Poland always seemed easier when confronting a common enemy. This time, that would be him. He shook his head. What a quandary. Made worse by another reality. Hastily planned operations nearly always came with problems. He had a bad feeling that some detail, now tiny, could later reveal itself and grow into something fatal. Something out of his control. But he realized that doubt always accompanied responsibility. So he sucked in a few deep breaths and steeled himself. Sonia appeared at the entrance and walked toward him across the parquet floor. The elevator is coming up from level 9. He stood. I'm not waiting here, so don't tell me to. I wasn't planning on it. You have any idea who's coming up? She shook her head. Let's hope whoever they are have what they came for. And if they don't, then we'll go find it. He loved her determination. Never an ounce of pessimism. I think I need a divorce. She smiled. That's the anxiety talking. It's a man who loves you talking. Why can't I be happy too? Because you're the president of this country, and Poland will never tolerate a leader who divorces while in office. You know that. I'm tired of living a lie. It seems you've been doing that for a long time. She knew nothing about the protocol, only fleeting references here and there. He needed to tell her. But now was not the time. So he only said, there's more to this than you think. That's always the case. We'll talk, once this is done. Janusz, I don't care what you did. I'm sure whatever it was, you did it out of necessity. I was 10 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed. Those were tough times. People did whatever they had to do in order to survive. Me, you. No one can judge them by today's standards. She paused. And who am I to judge anyone? I shot a man in cold blood today, and he was not the first. So I really don't give a damn what you did. He smiled. So practical, too. Come with me, she said. There's a place where we can watch that elevator when it arrives. And he followed her from the hall. Chapter 70. Cotton stopped at a corner in the tunnel. Remnants of incandescent light leaked around the edge, signaling that the exit foyer was on the other side, which was lit earlier when they arrived. He heard nothing save for the whine of the elevator as it rose. A quick glance around the edge and he saw 3 sets of coveralls lying on the floor, along with 3 helmets. They're gone, he said. Stephanie and Patricia came up from behind. He knew from their previous descent that this elevator only went to level 3. They'd switched to it earlier from another that rose to the surface. He pointed at the clothes. They intend to blend in with the crowd up on the lower levels and just walk out. But there was still the matter of the gunshot. He stepped around the corner, approaching the pile of clothes and helmets. He studied the floor and noticed streaks in the fine layers of ground salt leading away toward a dark tunnel to his right. He followed the trail into the blackness, which continued about 20 feet to an offshoot, where he found the body of a man dressed in the same color coverall as Patrizia. Surely, the other guide either forced or bribed into cooperation, and the source of the gunshot. Ivan was not the type to leave loose ends. He headed back to the elevator. "There's a body," he said, as the name Conrad stitched to the coveralls. Shock filled Patrizia's face.
"David Conrad. I know him."
She paused.
"Knew him."
So far, this attractive young woman had handled herself like a pro, asking few questions. Even when the shot rang out in the chapel, she'd only momentarily panicked, then regained control. Now a murder. That might be too much. He needed her to keep thinking. "Call the elevator back down," he said to her. She stepped over to the control panel and used her fob to activate the up button, which lit to her touch. "What are you going to do?" Stephanie asked. "Cut them off." "Should we not have some help sent down? Surely this place has security people." He shook his head. "We can't risk losing that information. This one's on us." He saw she agreed. The elevator returned. He unzipped his coveralls. "We have to blend in too." Tchaikovsky stood on a sturdy wooden staircase that angled up from level 3 to level 2, blocked off for use by the mine manager. From the first stoop, it was easy to watch the elevators that led both up and down unobserved. The chamber that accommodated them was tall, spacious, and well-lit, with a polished salt floor, white timbers fronting two of the walls forming an impressive latticework of support. Lines had formed behind a rope barrier, the crowd a bit noisy and anxious to end their visit and head up to ground level. Sonya stood beside him as they waited for the lower-level elevator to open its doors. Thanks to the angle of the stairs and their location, none of the crowd could see them. "It will take time for all those people to leave here," he said. "The less attention, the better." She held the small walkie-talkie that was connected to an ancillary security center on level 1. He'd already noticed cameras, attached to the walls high up and aimed down at the elevators. "They have this place under video surveillance," he asked. She nodded. "That's a plus for us. There's nowhere for any of them to go." "I want those cameras shut off." She stared at him. "We can't have a record of this. Surely you can see that." And he saw that she did. She spoke into the radio and told the manager to shut off all cameras, on order of the President of Poland. The elevator that led down to the lower levels opened, and 3 men walked out. "The older one is Reinhardt," she said. "The younger is his hired help, Munoz. The big man is Ivan, the Russian." "I assume the plastic pack he's holding is what we're after," he asked. "Has to be. Safe and sealed." They watched as the 3 men casually turned right, away from the stairs, and stepped over a rope barrier, dissolving into the crowd, waiting their turn for the up elevators. "Bold," he said. "They have no idea we're watching. Do we allow them to go up first, or deal with them here?" She did not immediately answer. He assumed she was weighing the risks. "Ivan is a killer," she said. "He'll do whatever he has to do to get out of here. Better not to challenge him and allow him to go up. We can be there waiting when the elevator arrives." That made sense. "We'll watch them a little longer, though," she said, "to make sure they stay here." He reached over and grabbed her hand, squeezing hard. She returned the gesture and added a smile. For the first time, he believed this might be containable. The elevator from the lower levels opened again. Cotton Malone, Stephanie Nell, and another younger woman dressed as a mine guide stepped out. Malone gave the crowd behind the rope barrier a quick survey. A gun appeared in Ivan's hand, which was fired. Chapter 71 Eli saw Malone at the same time Ivan had,
and he'd not disagreed with firing a shot toward the ceiling. It generated the desired effect. People scattered in all directions, oblivious to the barrier that had held them back from the elevators. Like a stampede of cattle, they formed a surging wall toward where Malone stood, allowing him, Munoz, and Ivan to join the crowd fleeing in the opposite direction. They hustled down a wide-lit corridor, their walk alternately on salt and on wooden planks. These paths were nothing like those deep below, the walls polished smooth, the floors even smoother, with plenty of light. The route drained into a medium-sized chamber that displayed wooden chests, carts on iron wheels, and buckets used long ago in mining. The tourists kept going out the other exit, into the next tunnel. But Ivan stopped, and assumed a position behind one of the iron carts, gun in hand. "We deal with Malone here." He motioned to Munoz, who crouched behind another of the old carts, armed too. He was about to find his own cover when Ivan said to him, "Stay there." Out in the open? Which meant he was bait. Cotton headed in the direction that Ivan and his two cohorts had gone. All of the people had fled, leaving the wood-lined corridor clear. He held the gun in his right hand, retrieved from beneath his coveralls. Stephanie and Patrizia waited back near the elevators. The path was a straight line for about 50 feet, where it drained into an open doorway with darkness beyond. He approached the entrance and decided, as he had back in Bruges, that rushing in was foolish. Instead, he hugged the salt wall on the left side of the portal and risked a look beyond. He saw Reinhardt standing in the middle of a dimly lit chamber. But no Ivan or Munoz. Tchaikovsky had watched the mayhem that ensued after the Russian fired into the ceiling. Sonya had radioed the mine manager again and told him to shut off all the elevators going up. Too much chaos was happening to take a chance that their quarry might escape. This way, they were sealed below ground, along with everyone else. Malone had gone in pursuit, but Sonya had not insisted they follow. And he understood. So far, their presence was unknown, and it seemed better to keep it that way. But he did not want anyone hurt. Enough blood had been shed already. He and Sonya had quickly climbed the stairs to level 2, and following the manager's radio instructions, made their way to where the tunnels began a steady descent back down to level 3, hopefully on the opposite side of where Ivan had gone. With luck, their target would come straight to them. Eli froze. He'd seen a shadow approaching from the brightly lit tunnel beyond, which had abruptly stopped. Then he'd seen a head take a quick look past the portal's edge. Munoz and Ivan were ready with their weapons. Malone was obviously being cautious. He caught Munoz's gaze and motioned for him to shift positions, placing his man closer to the doorway, on this side of the opening. "I'm here, Malone," he called out. "Why don't we discuss this?" Cotton smelled a trap, but decided to not alert Reinhardt. "All right, let's talk. Come on out." He waited. Reinhardt appeared from the darkness. He stayed to his side of the doorway, offering no one on the other side a clear line of sight. If they wanted him, they'd have to come get him.
"I'm a bit surprised to see you here," Reinhardt said. "How did you know?"
"Lucky guess." Reinhardt smiled.
"A funny man. This is quite a serious situation. Yet you think humor in order."
He shrugged. "It's only serious for you. I'm on the side of might and right."
"Come now, Malone. Can't we be reasonable?
Where's Ivan?"
"Doing what Russians do best."
And Reinhardt added a sly smile, then dropped to the floor. Shots rang out from inside the chamber. Rounds whined past and found the salt and timbers farther down the tunnel, ricocheting off. He hoped Stephanie and Patrizia had taken cover. He stayed glued to the wall at the side of the opening. Reinhardt crawled back inside. He heard movement in the darkness beyond the doorway. A quick glance showed an empty chamber.
"Stephanie," he called out behind him. "We're here. I'm going after them."
"The elevators are not working," Patrizia told him. "They've been shut off from above."
Which meant something more was happening here. Stephanie and Patrizia appeared and hustled his way.
"Where does this route go?" he asked.
It winds back around to the main areas, past the lakes, Patrizia said. To the stairs. You two head up, any way you can. Keep these bastards down here. Don't give them a way out. Stephanie nodded, and she and Patrizia retreated toward the elevators. He headed the opposite direction. Chapter 72 Tchaikovsky stood inside a chamber filled with lit display cases that exhibited salt crystals in all colors, shapes, and sizes. He'd taken refuge here while Sonya assessed the unexpected situation. He wanted to be in charge, as always. He was president, after all, but realized that he had to keep a low profile. If they managed to contain this, he could not afford to be exposed any more than he already was. Bad enough that the mine manager was aware of his presence, and that he'd pulled rank with the order to shut off all the cameras. So the fewer people who knew anything, the better. There's more shooting below, Sonya said as she hurried into the room. Visitors have scattered. They're trying to get them all up to levels 1 and 2. The mine manager says he can't keep this quiet much longer. There are safety concerns, and his security people are pushing hard. He caught the message. This has to end. Now. We need to get down there, he said. Janosz. He loved when she used his name, which was rare. I can't risk anything happening to you, she said. Don't put me in that difficult situation. I need to get down there. Will you wait here? I'm the president of this country and your boss. This is not open to discussion. She tossed him a quizzical look. You're going there. Pulling rank. I am. Big surprise. She shook her head, then unzipped one of the pockets in her coveralls and removed a semi-automatic pistol. She handed the weapon over. I assume you know how to use it. Absolutely. Eli followed Ivan and Munoz. They'd laid down gunfire trying to hit Malone, but failed. It had provided them, though, with enough cover to flee. Now they were in a long traverse that led toward another low-ceilinged chamber displaying ancient mining equipment. They kept moving, unsure of their destination, only that they had to get back to ground level. But how? Malone was on their flank, and none of them knew what lay ahead. Ivan waddled along, heavy-legged, but spry for a big man, a gun in one hand, the plastic pack in the other. Good thing Jonty had thought ahead and properly protected the information. Malone had to be proceeding with caution, given that he, too, had no idea what was waiting for him. They entered an open corridor that ran 20 meters straight ahead, sloping upward, a tall salt wall to the right, a wooden railing on the left overlooking a small lake beyond. A strange sight, so far below ground. The clear water lay still like glass, the bottom illuminated by underwater lights that cast an eerie emerald glow. Obviously, there had to be somewhere for all the water that seeped down to go, so lakes seemed a reasonable solution. Ivan stopped. We cannot keep running. What do you suggest? The big man pointed down at the water and a short set of stairs that led to a tiny dock where 2 boats were tied. Eli studied the lake and saw that there were several exits where the water flowed out into black yawns. You're assuming one of those will get us away from Malone, he asked. Ivan nodded. Not us. Me. We need split up. Give Malone choices. I go in boat. You two keep moving ahead. And do what? Find way out. Get away. Disappear. Enjoy your money. Our business is done. There was wisdom in the strategy, particularly from his standpoint. Malone had to be after the information, but he'd have no way of knowing who possessed it. Best guess? Not the broker. The Russian. The one who fired the shot. And he'd not killed anyone, either. That bullet came from Ivan's gun. His own gun was still tucked at his waist, beneath the coveralls. Do svidaniya, Ivan said, waving with the gun he held. And goodbye to you too. Ivan stepped over a low gate in the railing, descended the stairs, then climbed into one of the skiffs. At its stern hung an electric motor, which he switched on and used to ease toward the tunnels. What do we do? Munoz asked. What he said. Get out of here. And they headed off. Cotton made his way through the chamber toward its other exit, careful as he sidestepped the old mining equipment on display. At the other exit, he saw Reinhard and Munoz 50 feet away, rushing down a railed corridor. Then darkness blotted them from sight as they entered another chamber. He turned toward the lit underground lake and saw Ivan puttering away in a small skiff, entering a black tunnel. They'd split up. He was betting that what he was after lay with Ivan. He noticed a padlocked gate, then stairs and another skiff floating atop the still water. He jumped the low rail and descended, hopping into the boat, following Ivan. Tchaikovsky knew how to handle a weapon, but it had been a long time since he'd held one. Solidarity had never been about violence. Weapons had been forbidden, as had been drinking. Never was anyone allowed to participate in official functions under the influence. Never was a knife or a gun allowed at a demonstration. Not that some didn't appear. But at no time had anyone in any position of authority ever sanctioned their presence. Quite the contrary, in fact. Visuals had been vital to the movement. What you said and what you did mattered, but what it looked like mattered more. They'd been trying to win the world over to their cause, and no better way existed than for their protests to be nonviolent. They'd not been 100% successful, but they'd come pretty close. Solidarity had always, then and now, been perceived as good, the government bad. But what would the Warsaw Protocol do to that legacy? Hard to say. Definitely nothing good. Quietly, he followed Sonya down a wooden staircase, the boards strong and firm under his feet. They were headed for level 3. The mine manager was working to evacuate everyone to the surface from levels 1 and 2. Last he saw, Malone had taken off in pursuit of Reinhardt and his man, Munoz, along with Ivan, all of them surely still on level 3. Sonya was armed with a map supplied by the manager, but it might not be needed. As they turned on the landing, preparing to head down the last flight of stairs, they spotted Eli Reinhardt 30 meters away, leaving the brightly lit chamber where the stairs ended and entering another dark tunnel. They headed in the same direction. Chapter 73 Cotton navigated the boat across the lake and headed for the tunnel where Ivan had gone. He left the lit surface and entered blackness. If not for another illuminated lake about 50 feet ahead, his visibility would have been zero. Things were also a little too close for comfort, as the ceiling was less than a foot away. The small electric motor provided nothing in the way of speed, so he puttered along.